What a pleasure it is to be here with you today. This is not my first time to this church, and I actually have been an usher here for Stan and Leslie's wedding. And what a beautiful space it is, and so it's lovely to also now get the opportunity to actually share in Stan and Leslie's spiritual community and to join you all in the worship today and moments of remembrance and renewal. I would also like to give thanks to Merrill and to Dana. What extraordinary stewards you have, and what care they put into designing and putting this program together. So thank you, Merrill, and thank you, Dana, for choosing such wonderful and beautiful music. When I started thinking about what to share with you all today, I by that time had received the sample order of service, and the doctrine is there in the, you know, in the affirmation of faith. I was really struck by the sentiments there, and especially the first line, which goes, "Love is the doctrine of this church," and it's exactly what I wanted to talk about. So in many ways, I guess that what I want to do today is kind of share some of the ways in which I have come to understand over the years that that phrase, that love is the doctrine of this church. So the title for today's sermon or talk, whichever one you'd like to call it, is taken from a beautiful love poem by Ibn al-Arabi, who died in the 13th century, Muslim contemplative. This reader was a Renaissance man, a jurist, a scholar, a poet, and a mystic, contemplative as well. So the last verses of that poem go something like this. "My heart has become capable of taking all forms. For gazelles, a meadow, a cloister for monks, a house for the idols, the Kaaba for the pilgrim, the tablets of the Torah, and the book of the Quran. I profess the religion of love. Wherever its caravan turns along the way, that is the belief, the faith I keep." So yes, love is the doctrine of this church, and that's exactly what Ibn al-Arabi is talking about. And my heart has become capable of taking all forms. This question, what is the heart, is something I would like to spend a little bit of time on. The answer that I've come to, not just on my own, that I've learned through reading people like Ibn al-Arabi or Jalaluddin Rumi, whose words you just heard, these great beings, you know, 700 years ago, but seem to know us and our travails and our needs better than we do sometimes ourselves. You know, that's the way it feels sometimes when one reaches for their books and their words. So the question of what is this heart that is capable of taking all forms? I would just share a few biographical notes about that. I grew up in Pakistan, and like, you know, most students growing up, young people growing up, was focused on doing science. That was something that was a cultural kind of given almost. And you study either medicine, or you study engineering, or business, or computers. By that time, computers had come about, so one more field of, learning had been added to it. And I think there's a couple of reasons for that, why so much emphasis has been placed in a lot of, I guess, former colonies, I would say, you know, Pakistan being one of them, colonized by the British. Part of it was, of course, that the world had changed, and these kinds of professions ensure that one is able to make a good living and have a family, support that family. So, of course, parents everywhere, find myself in that capacity now, want the best for their children, so that's pretty understandable. But there was another reason as well, which was that I think one of the diagnoses, cultural diagnoses, had been that why was it that we got colonized, these countries? And part of it was the technology. We just didn't have the right technology to be able to fight these invaders, you know? So, for multiple reasons, a lot of emphasis was placed in science. So, given this cultural climate, I also was going to go into science, despite the fact that, while growing up, some of the older values of my culture in Pakistan, which is, you know, Indian subcontinent, and then I later find out it's actually across the entire Balkans to the Bengal, this emphasis on poetry was so much alive. Like everywhere, everybody knew reams and reams of poetry. My illiterate grandmother knew, probably knew more poetry than I do right now. couldn't read or write, but had some of the greatest poets, you know, who were usually also saints in the tradition, people like Ibn Arabi or Rumi, you know, memorized their words. So there was a lot of wisdom shared by people. So poetry was very important, you know. You just, if you could have the right verse for the right moment, that would seal an argument, you know. Yeah, right? And I still remember as a kid that my dad would rarely come to the street to get me off of the street. Come back in. The only time he did was once a year when there was a national poetry recitation on TV. There was one channel on the TV, and every year, at least once, there was all the great poets in the country would be invited, and there would be a live showing of that. And you did not want to miss that. So that's when I would also rush in, all the kids, the streets would get deserted. Like, imagine kids playing, deserted, streets deserted because of wanting to go and listen to the poets. So there was such a value given to the word, such a value given to what poetry is able to do. And the word for poetry in Arabic, in Urdu, in Persian, is the same word. It's called shir. It literally means awareness. So shayari is poetry. So a verse is called shir. Shayari is awareness making. So a poet is somebody who's able to create awareness of something, have us be able to see something. So this power of poetry was very much there. So this is the culture I'm growing up in. I go into studying science, and I was a very good student. By the time I started studying physics in ninth grade, biology, chemistry were fine, you just had to memorize them. Physics somehow demanded understanding, and for the first 3 months in ninth grade, I just totally flunked every, which was kind of funny because I was doing fine in every other course, so it was obvious that it was not slacking off, it was not that I was not paying attention to it. Something was missing, so I just kept on, like, week after week, the quizzes, it was just a big, nice, red F on my transcript. So, it was funny initially, then it started to get a little bit worrisome because, you know, midterm exams were coming around, and you can't really hide, you can hide quizzes from your parents, but, you know, they're going to see the results. So I said, let me try and start anew, let me start reading it anew. So I started from the beginning of the book again, I still remember the moment, and then it clicked. And what clicked was that I had been misreading a physics text. I had been reading for multiple levels of meaning, allusions, depths, whereas the text was designed to mean only what it said. There was only one level there. They meant exactly what they said and nothing more. I had to reduce myself, contract myself, use as I was to give multiple levels of meaning in order to get physics. I had to, you know, kind of read one level. So immediately it was as if a flip, switch had been flipped and started acing my physics exam, which was great, you know, because I learned how to speak the language. But in retrospect, I can see that that was a moment at which there was also this amazing realization at that moment that, wow, look at how precise this language is. I got hooked on science at that moment. How much control can you have over here to know exactly, to point out exactly what is being meant and nothing else? So I think that was a moment where a process began that culminated later on. I did so well in physics that I got a scholarship. I came to the US on a scholarship to study science, so my BA is in physics. But constriction, that reduction of myself to fit that language, somehow, unbeknownst to me, also resulted in my constriction of the world. And towards the end of my sophomore year, I found myself really living in a totally material world. I still remember a moment at which I sat and watched the sunset, and the light was nothing other than photons and these waves that were going around. I sat there and it did not touch my feelings at all. It was my mind just deconstructing it, and the poetry was gone from the sunset. The world had become totally flattened, you know, because I had taken on this so well. So this was not conscious on my part. It just somehow, I think it's like, just like we get infected by art, I think ideas come in and then they spread through me. So that was a moment of crisis for me. There were so many things that were within me that could not find their expression through the learning that I had thought would have all the answers, or that was enough to the human being. So then became a process of figuring out what is needed. I needed to find a container that was big enough that could do justice to my feelings as well. You know, I found an ache within me. So what is this ache? You know, physics doesn't want to deal with it. If you can measure it, you know, we don't want to talk about it. So I started turning towards some of the wisdom figures, you know, junior year. And that's when I discovered this poem by Ibn Arabi and the works of Rumi. And there I found, you know, Meryl spoke about how I love to find containers that are spacious enough, wide enough, big enough to hold what seemed like contradictions. And it was in the writings of Rumi and Ibn Arabi that I found that there is no necessary contradiction between religion and science, or between reason and feeling. One needs to have a big enough container that can hold all of them together. So that has been my life's work. And I continue to try and do the same in multiple domains, whether it's religion, whether it's different religions, or whether it's religion and science, or whether it's feeling, mind or body. So that's where these verses come. My heart has become capable of taking all forms. What is this reality? What is this heart? You know, for me, the heart was just a feeling thing, you know, something to be kind of, as a physicist, trained physicist, you need to move away from it. You have to be objective. So how do I put the poet and the objectivist within me together? So Ibn Arabi is doing it through the heart. So what is this reality? So it turns out that the heart, according to most pre-modern cultures, is the seat of our awareness. The heart is that reality within us, that container within us, that is able to hold multiple perspectives, differing viewpoints. And if reason proceeds, reason is something that proceeds step by step by step. There's a thesis, another thesis, on the basis of the two, you derive a conclusion. That's the function of reason. But the heart is equivalent almost to the intellect. So the heart and the intellect are synonymously used. And I was confused about that. I thought intellect, it was the same as reason. It turns out intellect is not the same as reason. Intellect is the thing within us that actually sees. When we are reasoning about something, there are things that we apply the reason to. The thing in us that is seeing, the seer, the watcher within, that is identical with our intellect. That is what is being spoken of as the heart. So for Ibn Arabi, the heart, using the physical imagery and the physical organ, contracts and expands. So the contraction is one eye of the heart, and the expansion is the other eye of the heart. And it contracts and expands between reason and imagination, between differentiating things. This is not being seen, this similarity, which was the training of a scientist. This is not that. We have to analyze, separate things, put them apart from each other. But then there has to be a synthetic function as well. And that synthesizing function is imagination that immediately puts everything together into one image. So for him, human process of cognition and knowing moves back and forth, just like the beating of the heart. But it's obvious that this heart, present in everybody, but we also might need to develop this a little bit as well. So I wanted to read the rest of the poem for you, to which these verses were the culmination, that my heart has become capable of taking every form. What is the path that Ibn Arabi shows us to getting to this place, to creating an organ that is able to host everything, to put another word, this lovely kind of hospitality, is able to see everything. So here is how he begins. He says, "Gentle now, doves of the thornberry and moringa thicket, don't add to my heartache your sighs. Don't add to my heartache your sighs. Gentle now, or your sad cooing will reveal the love I hide, the sorrow I keep covered. I echo back in the evening, in the morning, echo the longing of a love-sick lover, the moaning of the lost. In a grove of Ghada, spirits wrestled, bending the branches towards me, leaving me unraveled. They brought longing, breaking of the heart, and other new twists of pain, putting me through it. Who is there for me in Jam and the stony ground at Mina? Who for me at Tamarisk Grove, or at the way station of Naaman. Hour by hour, they circle my heart, these heartaches, in rapture, in loving, and touch the water, the wind, the earth, the fire in me with a kiss. My heart has become capable of taking all forms. For gazelles, a meadow, a cloister for monks, a house for the idols, the Kaaba for the pilgrim, the tablets of the Torah and the book of the Quran. I profess the religion of love wherever its caravan turns along the way. That is the belief, the faith I take. So where does it begin? It begins with his longing. It begins in the body. It begins with perhaps the most real thing to us. Let anybody come and deny our pain, right? That's what we are feeling. What is closest to us in that way? The longing that he's feeling. His beloved is not there. It's in the absence of the beloved. He's standing there and the world is colored by his interior state. His heartache is being mirrored in the cooing of the doves, the sighs. And just this last Ramadan, during the month of fasting, this poem came back to me in another way. It was one of those beautiful summer days where it was cool, there were winds that were blowing, and there were the kind of winds where the whole tree sometimes, the branches, you know, these laden branches, green branches, go down and then stay down for a little bit, right? And then they slowly come back up until the next gust comes and then the branches come down. So there's a moment of just like, almost like things are giving way and then they rise up again. And I thought of this poem at that moment. How that world, at that moment, because perhaps I was fasting, there was a tenderness in the movement of the branches of the tree and the wind. Their play was reflecting my interior state as well. So this new formulation for me took place at that moment. That one follows one's longing. This is the path of longing. In order to get to a cultural place of being able to see other people's different religions as not only valid, but actually being able to appreciate them, one has to begin with one's own yearning. One has to begin with what is in one's body. One has to begin with what is most real to us and follow that outward. And it's somehow that reaching out, our own ache, heartache, our own desire, our own yearning, our own longing, right? I love that word, longing. It elongates, it reaches out. It is through it that we reach out to others. So the path, for Ibn Arabi in this poem that he's showing, is the path of longing. So we need to cultivate this longing, not run away from it. The feelings that we feel, the things that we desire, we have to pay attention to this desire. And I think what I also love about this is, this poem is that one enters in to the human realm through the realm of nature. You know, my heart has become capable of taking all forms. A pasture for the gazelle. So the first thing he is feeling is the hunger in the belly of the gazelle. That's a true bridging of species, of barriers. To somehow in a moment of intuition, knowing that this hunger is the hunger of of the gazelle. I'm reminded right now, I'm not planning on sharing this before, but of this wonderful episode in the book of Xuanzi, which is one of the world's classics coming from the Taoist tradition. Xuanzi and his friend, who's a philosopher, a linguistic philosopher, are standing by the side of the river Hao. And Xuanzi looks down and sees these fish swimming about. And he says to his friend, "Look how joyfully the fish swim in the river Hao." And the friend says to him, "You're not the fish. How do you know that the fish is joyful?" So Xuanzi says to his friend, "You're not me, so you don't know how, if I don't know that the fish are joyful." So beautiful, right? Example of how reason leads us to that impact. It's not possible for me to know the joy of this fish. And yet, he had felt it. Then what Xuanzi says is, "Okay, let's start all over again. I know it by standing on the bank of the river. I know it by being present to them and them being present to me." I see the same thing going on in Ibn Arabi over here. A kind of confidence we need to place in what arises within. That's a knowing as well. We need to put that on the same footing as reason too. Reason should not be discarded, you know? But at the same time, there is something that these intuitions give us, these feelings give us, that reason cannot. That's what's able to bridge across. So we go from the animal world, the hunger within the belly of the gazelle, to the human world, and the religious differences start to be bridged. So this heart that is now able to feel, you know, the branches of the trees, the wind, and the gazelle now coming back to the human world is able to be big enough that it can contain all of these different traditions. While being committed to one, and this is very important, this is one of the other things I find that's three key over here, that Ibn Arabi never stops practicing the rituals of his tradition. Differences are overcome, but at the level of the heart, not at the level of form. He does not practice the rituals of Judaism or Christianity, but he's able to see their beauty and see that they are true, and he can hold them within. So the place at which we hold them is not the place at which we act. This is very important. Very important. You know, it's like saying that, you know, other, you know, being able to say that all mothers in the world, you know, are as beloved to their children, perhaps, as my mother is to mine. So my mother is the best mother in the world, but other mothers are also the best mothers in the world. Just start living in a world of excellence, as opposed to there's one good and everything else is low. It's interesting, it raises everything up. So this to me, I'm running a little bit of out of time here, so shorten it a little bit. This for me is a realization, a making real of the vision of the Quran and the teachings of the Quran. If you look at your programs, there's a verse of the Quran there that says, "Have you not seen how to God bow all who are in the heavens and all who are in the earth, the sun and the moon, the stars and the mountains, the trees and the beasts, and many of mankind?" This is the Quranic universalism. Every being, by the fact of existing, is participating in the one religion. That's the Quranic universalism. And Ibn Arabi, though, has confirmed it for himself. So that's what is opened up, that the scripture provides a vision of what everything is. And it's up to us to try and cultivate a practice through which we can get to a place where we can actually see the reality of it. We have to realize that and make it real. And the Quran says the same thing about the multiplicity of prophecy as well. According to the Quran, there's only one religion, Islam, which means, this is, but not his, this historical Islam, which is also true, it is Islam, but it is a religion of the heavens and the earth and the sun and the moon and all the prophets who have come before Muhammad. All the way from Adam through Moses through Jesus. They're all called Muslims in the Quran. They're all Muslims. They're all Muslims. That's the Quranic vision. So that's at the level, that's what I was taught growing up. At the same time that, you know, I shared this story with the kids, we heard those stories, but at the same time, there were as many stories about Jesus or Moses and other prophets that we heard too. So the Islamic imagination, the imagination of the Islamic child, is shaped by all of these prophets. They're all considered prophets of God. Maybe I'll just end with a prayer that maybe all find a way through committing to a practice, through being able to pay attention to our heartaches and our longings, and know that they are the path, they are the doors as well. As much knowledge as there is in thinking about things, there's also a profound knowledge in those intuitions and those feelings. And where reason might hold us back, some of those feelings can open the door and allow us to connect with others. And that is definitely the way in which Ibn Arabi presents it. And that is a culmination, in many ways, of the Quranic teachings on what it means to be a person of faith. Is to see the faith in every being. Every being is walking along. It's faith. I think the challenge it throws to us, though, which is an important one, this is where reason comes in, that it means that our love, what we think of love specifically as one specific kind of nice way of being or feeling good, maybe even if it's associated with heartache, we have to be able to think of the predatory animals, for example. The gazelle's hunger is love, or the yearning and longing, so is the lion going after the prey. So there's something about this love that is a little bit big that asks us to start to discriminate a little bit as well. Just because it's love does not mean everything is fine for us. So that's why reason and imagination have to be held. So maybe I'll find the path, and it's such a joy to be with you.